Night gathers, and now our podcast begins. It shall not end until we're done talking. We are
the princes that were promised.
All right. Hello. Hello, and welcome to the princes that were promised, the wardens of Long Island, the watchers on the couch. What I wanted to do today is talk about who we consider the main characters of season one. We both agree that Ned is a main character, Robert Baratheon. Catelyn Stark, would you put her as a main character?
I think you have to, I guess. Yeah. She's just a chess piece moving character that she's got to be part of the top five or six. Mm-hmm.
Tyrion, obviously. Although he's more of a supporting role.
What he does
affects
so much of other stuff. Like where a count does the same stuff.
Or even not so much what he does, but what he's involved in.
Right.
And then Jon Snow and Daenerys Targaryen.
It's funny because they're major because out of all of them... Mm-hmm. These two major characters are off...
On opposite ends.
Opposite ends of the world. Of the plot of season one, really.
Right.
And they're all dealing with what they have to deal with. Jon is our major focus into the others.
The North.
The Wildlings.
The White Walkers and the Wildlings.
Dany is in the South. We're invited into a foreign country almost. We're seeing Dothraki, the marriage pact. They get her married to Khal Drogo.
Right.
And we're kind of actually being narrated by Jorah Mormont, in a way. Because Jorah has to explain things to Dany about customs of the Dothraki. So in a way, he's actually instructing us also. Right. What their traditions are and all that, too.
That's interesting. He functions for Daenerys the way that Ned functions for us as the reader.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing that for Daenerys, he does it for us again.
Right. The Dothraki went without at least three killings.
It's a dull affair.
Fair. Well, that might have been a... No, that was actually, I'll take that, but that was Illyrio, actually.
Yeah, but still.
We're getting the narration through other characters to help us out, who are actually helping Daenerys out with what's going on.
It's like we're introduced to Westeros through Ned, and then when we get to Essos, we're introduced to Essos through somebody from Westeros, who's a lot like Ned, or from the same region as Ned.
But with Jorah, it's like he knows so much, it seems like he knows so much. How long was he with the Dothraki? How does he know not to, bring a sword into Vaas Dothraki? Yeah. Did he try doing it and also get killed?
Trust me, you do not want to do that.
I tried doing it myself.
So Eddard Stark is the protagonist for season one. We've talked about in our Ned Stark podcast how he's the moral compass into this world. Functions the same way in the TV show. But also, the guy that we're rooting for, the guy we identify with, he's the good guy. As far as an antagonist, I don't think there's any one single character that works as the antagonist. I think it's, as a whole, House Lannister. More so Jaime, Cersei, and Tywin. Not so much Tyrion.
I definitely think, though, you kind of hate Cersei the most because she's more at the forefront. Like Jaime, we said, he's more of a supporting character in season one.
Yeah, more so than Cersei is.
And Cersei is just always around. So she's always around Joffrey, and you can't stand Joffrey.
Right.
And Cersei is almost like the mother of the bully in school.
Right.
Bully's always picking on someone, always starting fights.
My son did nothing wrong.
Principal, you gotta say, call it like a parent meeting down, like that, my son.
Right.
My son's an angel. And that's, you just look at her that way, and you just can't stand her.
Right. She's a lot like that. But worse, because she has her own motives.
Not only does she, manipulate her son up, but she's also manipulates herself up, too. Like, she also makes it so that she's also very powerful.
Right.
That she's always staying around. She's not going back to Castle Rock.
No, never. She makes sure of that.
King's Landing. Yeah. This is where I'm going to be.
And Ned is just getting in the way of that. And where Ned thinks he's being compassionate to her, she's like, all right, he's totally giving me an opening. This guy's an idiot. Robert Baratheon represents the status quo. Obviously, he is king of Westeros, and he has been for 16 years.
Well, TV-wise, 16 years.
Okay.
Probably book-wise, it's 14.
Yeah, right. But they have to make everybody a little bit older. So he represents the status quo in more ways than I initially thought. He is the law of the land of Westeros, but his physical appearance and how it's changed from when he first became king, bloated, like gorging himself on food and drink and whores, not handling this ultimate power in a responsible way or in a healthy way, or unable to handle the stress of it all. Surrounded by Lannisters, by people who want to take advantage of the position he's in to empower themselves. And I think that's Robert Baratheon, the character, but I also think that's a good metaphor for where Westeros is at this point in time. Had all these years of peace since the Targaryens have been snuffed out and the Mad King killed, but it's coming apart at the seams. There are old wounds that are not healing and they're going to be torn open again. And I think Robert's a very good representation of that. Whereas Catelyn and Tyrion, like you said,
they're the chess pieces.
They represent the chaos and the moves they make or the things they're involved with. They'll help to fracture Westeros, and they do end up fracturing Westeros. And the positions that they're in, Catelyn is married to Ned, and Tyrion is the brother to the queen. They're not quite so powerful where they can make a decision and have it affect Westeros, but things that they do
ultimately affect it.
Right. Only because they're in a specific situation. Catelyn wouldn't be making these decisions if she wasn't...
Bonehead?
Right. Well, if she wasn't Bonehead, but also if there was no attempt on Bran's life, then we wouldn't be in this situation. And it's like one incident leads to another, leads to another, leads to another.
It's a domino effect. And with Catelyn, pretty much every decision she does is a bad one. I mean, has she ever done anything?
No.
The book or the show, has there ever been a decision that she's done that's been a positive one?
I mean, she's had good ideas like... Rob naming a... No, that wasn't even her idea. She didn't even want Rob to write a will, right?
No. Was she the one that recommended that you needed a hand?
No.
Well, she wasn't against it. Well, it wasn't her idea.
Right.
It's when we talked about the War of the Five Kings that Rob's doing when they're at
John.
Yeah. She knows, like, oh, no, you can't, you know. Yeah. Again, another, like...
Come on. Seriously? We're, like, right here in the middle of fucking the Riverlands.
Right, and she's still kind of, like... Still has to find a way, be like Mother Hen, and just, like, still try, like...
I'm in charge.
Yeah, he's the king. If he's the king of the world, he's got to make a decision. It wasn't even a decision, though. I mean, she was correct about her insecurities about Theon Greyjoy. That might be the only time where she was kind of, like... No, you shouldn't have been correct. Or probably a positive outlook.
But she only felt that way because Ned... The reason they had Theon was to keep control of Balon Greyjoy.
Right.
And I think it wasn't so much that she didn't trust Theon as it was... She didn't want to let go of that control.
Right. You're giving a Snicker bar to a 3-year-old, pretty much, by giving...
Right.
You know?
Right. Exactly. A Snicker bar and like a can of Coke.
Yeah.
And you're like, all right, you know, go nuts. Kind of brought up an interesting point, and you brought it up before too, and it's the comparison of Catelyn Stark and Cersei Lannister. Because Catelyn, while she's painted as a good guy, just wanting the right thing for her family and whatever the fuck, she's not that much different than Cersei Lannister. Maybe she wouldn't go to the depths, to the extremes that Cersei would go to, but... She's like trying Cersei, to control her Rob. Right.
They both love their children.
Right.
They'll go out of way to protect their children.
Right. Honestly, to me, Cersei just seems like she's more honest about what she's doing. Catelyn she's trying to manipulate Rob, but not seem like she's manipulating Rob. She's trying to keep herself in the picture, like kind of like as the king's mom, but not make it look like she wants to do that. Meanwhile, every time Rob tries to send her away, she doesn't want to go anywhere. She finds a new reason to stay and keep getting involved. Cersei's doing the same thing, getting involved, but she's not like, my husband's dying, I have to stay here, like... Make no mistake about it. I'm the queen, and I deserve it. And that's why I'm staying here.
They're both similar. I think, like, with Cersei, though, is she knows how to use her power more than Catelyn does. She knows, and she's got more power with her being in King's Landing. Right. You know, that's that whole time. If you have King's Landing, you have a lot of control.
Yeah.
Cersei is definitely more out there in a more direct...
Right.
Way of doing it, where Catelyn is more of a
more
subliminal.
Yeah.
Where she thinks she's doing no harm, but she really is. Like, I think like Cersei knows what she's doing. Like, Cersei is very intelligent.
Well, that's
Catelyn doesn't think she's, when all these decisions are that she's making, she doesn't think, she just is going on her instinct. I don't think she really realizes what she's doing.
You don't think she does, but it's possible that she does. Because here's my point. Like, this is the argument. Does Catelyn know how much of a difference she's making in Rob's rule just by being there and poking her nose in? Or does she think that she's just like trying to do the right thing? I would say based on her track record, based on all of the domino effects that she starts, all of the bad decisions that she makes and she manipulates other people into making, I think she almost gets off on being in a position of authority and power. If you think about Catelyn's life, being the firstborn, Tully, she's older than Edmure. She's older than...
No. Lysa, yeah. She's the youngest one.
No, Edmure's the youngest one. We gotta look this up now, bro. We want to go to... What, Tower of the Hand, you think?
I could have sworn the mother died at the childbirth because of her.
You might be right, but no, because I know for sure that Edmure... I know Edmure's younger than her. I know it. I'm pretty sure Lysa is also. Family duty on a hook, line, and sinker. Yeah, Catelyn Tully. Eldest daughter, Lord Hoster, Lysa, and then Edmure. Yep.
What? No. Yeah. Something's wrong here. Something is wrong here. No.
Oh, you're right. She did die in childbirth, along with the son she was trying to deliver, which was not Edmure. So I guess they tried to have another baby after Edmure.
I'm not wrong. You know what? I'm not wrong. It must be a show thing that they said that she died because of Catelyn's childbirth.
That's totally possible. That's probably totally possible.
I'm wrong, but I'm not wrong. I'm just getting confused. It's the scene in Brienne. She says something about childbirth.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm telling you.
No, I believe you. I believe in the show. It might be the way. Honestly, like, I kind of remember.
That would just be so stupid. How can you make her out to be the youngest child? As a show thing.
Yeah.
That makes really no point.
Lysa looks a lot older than Catelyn. Later they get to play Lysa. She looks a lot older than Catelyn.
Well, hold on, too.
It wouldn't matter either way with Edmure.
I should realize that Catelyn was older, because if Lysa was older, you would think that she probably been promised to Brandon and not Catelyn.
Right.
So,
point being, is the way she was raised as the eldest daughter of Hossa Tully, knowing that she's not going to be his heir, especially once Edmure is born.
Sure, at that time, by the time that marriage pact was made, Edmure's alive, so he knows
right,
he is.
Right. She was raised being taught how to rule, at least how to run a castle. And I think much like Cersei, to be sold off almost as property, that bothers her. It's like Jaime said, Brandon was the real fire, different kind of man. I'm paraphrasing that, however he says it. But I think there's something to that. I think there's something to...
Brandon was better looking than Ned. Ned was average. And that's why when you describe Ned, and then you describe John, you know right off the bat that there's got to be a difference. There's not, because John, in Ygritte's eyes, is described as iconic, like beautiful.
Right.
Where Ned is not, never described.
Ned's just plain old Jane.
Old Jim or something.
Yeah. Boring Ned, yeah. I think there's something to the fact that Catelyn Tully is not happy with how her life has turned out, and I think from the moment she eggs Ned on to go to King's Landing, begs him to stay, but at the same time pushes him out the door, I think she is enjoying the drama, trying
to control her son.
And trying to control her son and being in a position of authority. And it's not something she wants to let go of. Where Cersei is the same thing, but Cersei doesn't lie about it. She's not pretending that it's something it's not.
Because as we all know, Robb Stark is Catelyn's child with Brandon.
Right, obviously.
It's just amazing the amount of theories and babies that Brandon has with so many different people. Catelyn, with Lyanna, Ashara. Because there's theories out there that Brandon raped Lyanna. And that John is the son of Brandon and Lyanna. And Lyanna was just so upset by this, she ran off with Rhaegar, and that's why Brandon had to go run down to get him back,
because she couldn't tell anybody.
The truth couldn't be known, right.
The guy is just like, he's just like some fucking doofus, doesn't use his head. But when you think about Catelyn in these terms, it's hard not to dislike her more than I already dislike her, but there's a way that she can't be aware of all the things that she's doing and continue to do them if she is as intelligent a person as she comes off as. You know what I'm saying? Like, she knows a bit of Warcraft. She's not dumb. She knows Warcraft. She knows what Rob has to do to beat Tywin, or at least hang with Tywin in the field. She knows what decisions to make.
She's smart enough to realize that, if you lose Rob, you're not just losing how Stark is done. She knows that.
Yeah. But she wants to take that gamble anyway. She's not good people.
No. That's why she's number one of my least favorite, most hated character.
And it's interesting that, I mean, obviously, this is going to the books, but it's interesting that she comes back now as Lady Stoneheart and evil. She's evil. She's driven by revenge, but she's got nobody to blame but herself, really, for everything that has happened to her and her family. Blame Jamie. You can't. We even talked about it before. You can't really blame Walder Frey. We get why he did that. It's not right, but is he any worse than Catelyn?
And what's funny is I just feel as if even Lady Stoneheart in the books, and we know some of what she's doing, but you almost get the sense that she's going to continue to screw up, and she's going to kill someone, maybe possibly kill someone, possibly kill someone that maybe she shouldn't be killing, or she's going to be doing. You know, obviously, with this, I'm very intrigued in The Winds of Winter.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to happen with Lady Stoneheart, Brienne, and Jamie?
Yeah.
I'm very intrigued what's going
to
happen
there. That's one of the things I'm most looking forward to is what happens.
That's like top three for me. Like, what's going to happen there?
And I hope it's not where Jamie is killed because of Lady Stoneheart. I don't think so either.
The show would have done something by now. Just had to have done something. I don't think it's Brienne either. I don't know. I just don't know. I'm very intrigued, though. That's one of my most intriguing stories.
I don't think George Martin knows that.
Oh, no, that's... Well, I'm still stuck on the whole entire triangle here.
I'm a gardener.
Maybe I have to kill Brienne. I said sword, but I gotta change it.
How about Tyrion? Tyrion, an agent of chaos, functions a lot in the same way that Catelyn does, but he doesn't make as many decisions. He's more of setting things in motion because of positions that he's in, getting captured by Catelyn, having to escape from the Vale, having to work his way out of the Vale sky cell just to have a trial by combat.
I love that scene in the trial by combat.
Yeah.
Very well, I call my brother, Jaime Lannister. He's so confident in that. Like, because he knows, and everyone knows. And Elisa's like, there's no way that's happening. Because everyone knows.
Are you going to say that? No. You're not kidding. You're not, no Jaime.
Because if you bring Jaime down, I know I have no knight here who's going to kill Jaime Lannister.
Right. But Jaime Lannister.
I love that about Tyrion. It's like, he just always knows. Well, I got my brother, Jaime.
Because
he knows. Like, it's like you're in a basketball game and you got to play 2-on-2. You need a partner.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, who's gonna be a partner? Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
No, it's not.
Definitely not.
I'm calling your brother's Michael Jordan.
Right.
Basically, is what's happening. You're going against like two NBA guys, and you're not an NBA guy at all. Right. But like, okay,
Michael Jordan's my brother's cool.
My brother's Michael Jordan. I'm getting my brother Michael Jordan. No, you're not getting Michael Jordan. No. Not happening.
Anybody here? Yeah. They're willing, but not Michael Jordan.
You get Woody Harrelson over there. Okay, you're not getting Michael Jordan.
We'll even give you Wesley Snipes, but you know Michael Jordan. Not happening. But Tyrion, by the end of season one, he takes his fate into his own hands, and he's more like a Catelyn, where his decisions have repercussions. We'll see it more in season two when we go over that, but when he has the power to knock over the dominoes, instead of being one of the dominoes being knocked over, the results are a lot better. Because he knows what he's doing, and he's thinking about how the dominoes will fall and what effect that will have. Whereas Catelyn's just knocking over dominoes wherever just to say...
He thinks a lot of his decision-making, and we get on to season two, that whole entire scene when he tells Littlefinger, Varys, and
Pycelle... He's trying to figure out who the leak to the
Cersei. He gives them three different stories because he knows he can't trust any of them.
Right.
So he's going to try to put it on them, which one of them...
Right.
Is the most leastful trustful that he's going to get caught on, and all of a sudden it's Pycelle.
Yeah.
Oh, what a dirty pervert he is, really. He's such a dirty pervert. Yeah. Specifically in the show. But the show, they really, like, it's like all those, like...
They dial it up.
Oh, my God. He was in Empire Strikes Back, by the way.
Yeah, he was. I saw that. Yep.
He was also in Indiana Jones, also.
He was the third one, right? Last Crusade? Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Jon Snow and Daenerys Targaryen and how they function as, well, Jon Snow, as we talked about this before, either end of the spectrum away from the main plot line. But Jon, he is not a threat himself, but he functions as our gateway to this existential threat, right? This threat that not everyone believes is really a threat. Whereas Daenerys, she's a preconceived threat by the status quo. The Targaryens are a threat. Daenerys is a threat, especially now that she's pregnant with child. And Jon, who's actually more of a threat to Robert's reign.
Right. I was just going to say that. Jon is a bigger threat than Dany is because What varies knows in the books, and I think I've always said this. Let's put it this way. The battle for the Dorne is over. Let's say Dany survives. Presumably the dragons die out. Will the North ever bow down to Dany, whose father killed
Rickard
and Brandon? With the North, she's always going to have that stigmata. Whereas John, when the truth comes out, he, unlike Dany, doesn't need dragons to get people around him to support him. Because he'll have the North. Because he's a Stark, he's Lyanna's son. He's also going to get the South. Because one thing that even Robert knows is people loved Rhaegar.
Yeah.
So Rhaegar's son, it will trump Dany.
Rhaegar's son will trump the Mad King's daughter.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
That's basically what I'm saying. Yeah. Rhaegar's child will trump the Mad King's child. Obviously, without like dragons. Obviously, we might have a whole like Torrhen Stark situation again where we can't risk being killed by dragons, so we'll just bow.
Right, but looking at it more metaphorically, that's what it is. Rhaegar's son with a daughter of the North obviously trumps the Mad King's daughter.
Right.
Who's responsible for killing the Warden of the North and his heir.
And his heir. I think it's pretty safe to say that every character has been somewhat mentioned to other characters. However, never once in John's POVs, anything from even Samwell, that John is around. This is actually Samwell and Maester Aemon when they talk about Dany. John's not there.
Right, no, John isn't there.
They have no parting of dialogue between them. John is never told about, oh, there's a dragon lady. There's this one, Daenerys Targaryen and Essos. Same way with Dany. She's never told about, oh, the Lord Commander is Jon Snow. They never cross paths.
Right.
They are never told about each other.
You're right.
There's never any kind of, you know.
Right.
Jorah always talks about Eddard Stark. He'll talk about Eddard. You don't hear about, well, you know, his bastard son is the Lord Commander at the Wall. Obviously, he wouldn't know that. But no one comes to Dany and say, listen.
Does Jorah even know he's the Lord Commander? How would Jorah know?
No. I mean, as of right now, I only think he knows that his father, in the book-wise, I only think he probably knows that his father is dead. In the show, he finds, you know, Tyrion tells him, and Tyrion's like, oh, crap, I didn't realize you didn't know.
He was pretty upset about it. But he tried to play off like he wasn't. I'm glad they went that route in the TV show. As much as I like Griff and Young Griff, I'm glad they're not including them in the TV show. Because I liked that Jorah-Tyrion relationship got to be more in-depth than it is in the books. That's interesting stuff. They don't know about each other.
Right. Never once do you hear, like, John, what about this dragon queen in Essos? She's got three dragons. Not once is that said.
If anything, Dany knows at least whispers about Rhaegar and Lyanna.
From Ian Viserys, there was that conversation that Viserys had one time that, you know, I think Viserys said something to her to the fact. He mentioned it. Viserys mentioned to her that, you know, her brother went off with another woman. And then Daenerys brings it up. Viserys told me, you know, how come, you know. She knows about Rhaegar and Lyanna. She knows that it started, probably the war probably started because Rhaegar took Lyanna. But no inclination that there's a baby.
There's a Jon Snow.
Which really, it just kind of dopey. You would just think if, even if it was rape, no one thinks, in this whole entire realm, no one thinks the possibility that there was a baby involved. Oh, Eddard just comes up north with a baby.
No.
I guess that's where a lot of people, these hipsters, get all these grand theories from.
If it was anybody but Eddard, maybe they wouldn't believe it. But Eddard is just known. You know, it's a combination of Eddard being known for his honor and being honorable, never tell a lie kind of guy. Plus everything else that was going on in the realm at the same time. And that's why he was able to slip Jon Snow under the radar. Because the Targaryen regime, which ruled for 298 years?
You know what's funny? I'm just thinking.
280 something years, whatever.
281 years, whatever.
It had just fallen. The realm was in turmoil. It's being put back together. It's just no one's going to think about that part of everything.
You know what I was just thinking about? You know what saves Eddard in all this? Is the fact that he did go to Starfall. If he would have gone from the Red Mountains of Dorne
back north
straight to Winterfell, it's going to be way too obvious. The fact that he goes to Starfall and visits Ashara Dane, that is a cover the child's identity. Because now you bring in Ashara Dane, and the Whispers of Ashara Dane is the mother. That's how it is in the books, too. The Whispers of that Ashara Dane is the mother, and obviously the crackpot theory is that there was a baby switch.
The underground baby switching network of Westeros.
There's baby switches everywhere.
Don't want your baby? We'll switch it with another baby. Baby not safe?
No
we'll
problem.
Switch with another baby. We got you covered. We have an endless supply of babies.
That trip to Starfall helps him.
It provides just enough cover story.
Right. Because now at Starfall, now all of a sudden, it brings up either Ashara Dane, it brings up Wyla into the fold, whereas he really would have to alive if he just goes straight from the Tower of Jordan back up north.
Well, even if that him going to Starfall and coming back with a baby looks shady, that's not like Ned. He's married to Catelyn Tully. Why would he have a bad... That's so not like Ned. Well, the Targaryens, their regime just fell. Like, who knows? Maybe we don't know Ned as well as we think we do. Just let it go. There's too much going on to really question what's going on with Ned and this baby.
Mm-hmm.
So most people take it at face value. Ned has that kind of capital where people just... They just believe him, you know? And everybody does believe him. He's the only one that can't accept the truth. Because it's not the truth. And he's the only one that knows it. I feel like for season one of Game of Thrones, a lot of ways for the books too, but just trying to focus just on the TV show. You have Robert Baratheon as Westeros, right? And you have Ned as a protagonist. And you have the Lannisters as the bad guys. Mm-hmm. And then you have Catelyn as a agent of chaos, but negative chaos. Everything she does...
Results in a negative. Or it results in other characters such as Ned doing negative things that hurt them.
She hurts the protagonists more than she does antagonists.
Right.
Even though...
She's trying to hurt the antagonists.
Right.
It's just like...
Whereas Tyrion, he's an agent for chaos in a positive way. Everything he does, maybe it's not good for the Starks, but it's good for the realm. Right? Tyrion's not tearing walls down.
Mm-hmm.
Tyrion's trying to fix things. He's a fixer.
Even early on, after Ned's death, I think he probably even sees something in episode 10, I believe, where Joffrey's abusing Sansa. He comes in protecting Sansa because he knows, listen, they have Jaime. If you start beating Sansa up, what do you think they're going to do to Jaime? Basically, they should have done it anyways.
Yeah.
You look back on it, they probably should have taken Theon Greyjoy's cut off his head and send it back. They probably should have killed Jaime right there and then. Here's his head. You took our father's head, now we took your brother's head. I'm sure Sansa would have died. I'm sure they probably would have killed Sansa for it, but that's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win. There we go. Win-win-win.
I thought that there was, you know, a win-win where I thought it was the best possible way, but I didn't realize there was a win-win-win. Win-win. Yeah. What's a win-win-win? That's when both sides win, plus the person who's negotiating also wins. This, however, is not likely a situation you want.
Poster is a t-shirt on your back. Win, win, win.
Angela gets to see the poster and...
You don't.
And you don't. And everyone wins. And I win. That's with a that's a top five episode. Because that's the one when he has all the files.
Oh, Dwight's files from New York. And Toby's
what's redacted mean?
Yeah. He's going through it. He's like, Michael's going through the files. He's like, I hit myself on the head with my phone today.
Yeah, I put in more coins.
And I took them all out.
And then there was the file for Michael. Because Michael's like, funny, there's nothing against me. I'm the best boss.
Yeah.
And they showed Toby. He's like, this here is Michael. This is just the first 3 months.
Yeah. Dude, the first, like, 4 or 5 seasons of that show were the best.
But that's when it was really, that midway to ending of season 2, where it was just really, it was everything.
Well, even season 3.
I think the first, 5 episodes of season 3 are just great. I love when the...
Okay, which one?
I love when they get the new people there in Scranton. And Anthony Gardner, which is so funny. You should fire Anthony Gardner. Yeah. And they're trying, and Michael's trying to do like he's doing
Come on, get on up there, buddy. Up there.
I can't do this.
For me,
I can't do this.
Yeah,
Dwight, come on.
No, I mean physically I can't. Oh, well, we got you.
Dwight, come on, get up. Stop it, put me down.
I don't know what I'm touching here.
That's also, I love when Dwight and Annie first meet, and they're shaking hands constantly, and like the next episode, and Annie's just trying to kiss up,
contact.
Trying to kiss up to Michael before Dwight is, and Annie's like, Michael, the way you carry yourself is with such a plume, Maria says, and then Dwight tries to say something like, and Michael, shut up.
Suck up, stop it. Assistant regional manager.
And I'm the director.
Like, director of sales. He's like, well, my title has director in it.
Well, I guess I'm in charge. Oh, no, I'm a director. Well, I'm a director, which on film means I'm the highest
The highest title of all. Do you know anything about film? He's like, I know everything about film. I've seen over 200 of them. Oh, man.
I never liked the fact that they're like friends at the end or something like that. I always thought they should have been planted against each other. Well, they kind of
know. Dwight got the job. At the end of the second to last season, he was the boss, and Dwight was Andy got the job, and Dwight was pissed about it. But then in the next season, Andy can't handle it, and then Dwight finally he gets the job, and Andy quits to go be an actor or whatever. I like the way it ended. I like the last few episodes, but once Michael Scott left, it was he should have called it there,
Or at least close up after that season. Say, listen, it was kind of not short notice or anything, but couldn't wrap it up in one season without Michael. We needed one. They did like what. Two seasons after.
Two full seasons.
Yeah, they should have done one full season.
They were like radically different. Like they were focusing on everybody. Even without the Jim Pam thing was what drove the first few seasons. Mm-hmm. Even not having that drama, it's still funny because you have Michael Scott and you have Dwight. But once you take Michael Scott out of the equation, Dwight's automatically not as funny. And
right.
You can't really have Jim and Dwight competing with each other. Because Michael is like older guys now. You know
Michael
what I mean?
Is just so...
He was just a perfect catalyst for all that.
Right. He was the...
like the glue.
Those other guys, as great as Dwight just said, as great as Dwight and Jim were, they weren't the number one guy. Michael Scott is number one because he's just such a... He's the number one guy.
Yeah. And he's not Michael Scott. He's that guy's funny. I like Ed Helms, but he's not Steve Carell. And I like the episodes when they had Will Ferrell, but that was really only one episode with Will Ferrell without Michael Scott. And then they had the... interview ones where they had like Jim Carrey was in it and Ray Romano. The show would have been better if they didn't have Robert California that next season. If they didn't have that character. But whatever. I mean, it is what it is. It's fucking The Office. But the first like four or five seasons, and I used to think the third season was my favorite. Dude, that fourth season is so fucking funny.
Yeah, it's really good.
The dinner party episode with the little fucking plastic TV.
This is what I got.
And then he's like, the window, the back door is broken. And she's like, it's actually a funny story. You want to tell it, Michael? He's like, nope. He's like, Michael heard the ice cream man. So he went running. Anyway, going back to this. Robert's in the middle and he represents Westeros, right? So you have Ned as a protagonist, the Lannisters as the antagonists. And I'm sure we can make this chart even bigger, but just with the main characters for season one. And I'd like to do this with each season as we go through it. Catelyn is chaotic, negative. Tyrion's chaotic, positive, and then you have Jon and you have Daenerys. Mm-hmm. And are they the same? Are they opposites? I think rules would say that rules of literary and visual narrative would say that they're opposites.
Mm-hmm.
With Jon being the existential threat, and when I say threat, not bad guy, just threat to the status quo, and Dany being the preconceived threat.
And it's funny in this season, and obviously the next couple seasons, both Jon and Dany. Have a Mormont advising them.
That's interesting. They do. So how do the Mormonts function? I bet you if we look deeper, there's other similarities. For instance, Catelyn and Cersei, I think there's a lot more to that. I think they're a lot more alike than we see. And the only reason we don't see it is because Catelyn's pretending to be this person that she's not. I think it's easier to see in the books. Not so much on the TV show, because I think that the way that... What's the actress's name that plays Catelyn?
Michelle Farley.
Michelle Fairley. I think she could have played that role better because there are evil intentions in Catelyn Stark. not so much evil. That's not the word I'm looking for. Selfish, definitely.
Definitely selfish. Definitely selfish. Independent.
Independently motivated.
Right. Not for the better good.
Taking advantage of the situation. Not for the good of House Stark. More for the good of Catelyn Stark.
Self-fulfillment.
Self-serving. Here's another interesting one. How about this? Keeping that in mind with Catelyn Tully, jumping ahead to season 6. And Sansa. And Sansa's return to the North. And how she kind of takes advantage of the situation with Rickon, with Jon Snow. She's a lot like her mother, with Littlefinger by her side.
Right. But, and about that, though, it backfires on Sansa a little bit. I think you're going to disagree, and I was a little bit on the wall on it. In my eyes, Littlefinger definitely thought that the North would side with Sansa. I think he was shocked by that, that they would follow a bastard.
You know what? I agree with you, except for if we make the argument that Littlefinger knew who Jon Snow was. Game of Thrones Littlefinger and A Song of Ice and Fire Littlefinger, they're not different characters, but one thinks much further ahead than the other. Song of Ice and Fire Littlefinger, in that situation, maybe he would think that the North would side with Sansa, but if he knows who Jon Snow is, he would have to account for that, and that possibility that just from his stock, from his genes, that a true leader comes through and is a wild card in that situation that has to be accounted for. Littlefinger's not leaving things to chance. That's not his style. If TV show Littlefinger knows about Jon Snow's heredity and who Jon Snow really is, I would think that he would, well, he kind of did account for Jon Snow as a possibility. He told Sansa what will happen, right? He told her that the North will side with Jon. What did he say in that list?
He raised the question, who is the North going to follow? And this is why I think he was surprised by this. The true-born daughter of Lord Eddard Stark and Catelyn Tully, or a motherless son from a woman in the South?
Well, he's right. They would follow Sansa Stark, but he's not son from a woman in the South.
But the North doesn't know that. Yeah. I think I mentioned before, if that was the South, and Sansa came in with the South with the Vale army to help out, they would go for Sansa.
She would have been queen. She would have been queen, yeah.
But in the North, it's different.
Because Jon Snow was in that. He was in the middle of that.
He was in the battle, middle of the battle, and there's, yeah, you know, Ramsay commented on it before, their day before a battle, where I keep on hearing stories about you, you know, according to the North, you're the realm's greatest, you know, warrior, you know. Yeah. So there's all this kind of talk, and here's Jon. Yeah, he was pinned up against it. Odds were like 5-1. He comes out of it alive. No harm, you know, he's not dead. He's right there. Right. The North takes that a lot they more into account that than, yeah, someone just, yeah, sitting on a horse.
They appreciate the assist.
And that's why,
no doubt,
it's a failure on Littlefinger to realize the differences between the North and the South.
Yeah.
That's where this failure comes in. He doesn't realize the North is different than the South.
He doesn't realize that. And how would he? Because what experience does he have with the North? I mean, technically, the Finger's a part of the Vale.
Yeah, he's never been in the North.
No. He's been ruled by the Vale. He's been ruled at King's Landing, but he's never experienced rule from the North. What he does experience of Ned Stark, he doesn't understand it. He doesn't expect the way Ned Stark ruled his hand to translate to what happens after Sansa brings the armies of the Vale. That's a good point. I like these comparisons, and I want to mm-hmm. get into them more as we do this TV show. I definitely like to make this chart when we get to season 2, because we'll have no Robert, we'll have no Ned.
But we'll get Stannis. But
we'll have Stannis, and we'll have a different chart to represent what's going on in Westeros, because all these characters, I mean, they are who they are, but they're also, they can be a metaphorical representation
and
of the realm.
It's funny how you get rid of Robert and Ned, but you add Stannis and Davos.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're both mm-hmm. kind of like, they bounce off each other, just kind of like similarly as Ned and Robert.
Just look at the Baratheon brothers. Robert, Stannis, Renly. Each of them.
the weirdest sets of brothers.
Oh my God. And I use that term loosely, brothers. But it's funny because, especially Robert and Stannis, they're so close in age. They each have a friend, lieutenant, whatever you want to call it, who is closer to them than their own brothers. You have Robert and Ned. You have Stannis and Davos. That's the one relationship. It's not like brothers, but there is love there. Especially on Davos's end, there's love there. And then you have Renly and Loras. There's definitely love there.
Yeah.
To the other extreme. Robert and Ned, they're buddies, friends. You could call them brothers in that sense, that they're so close. But their relationship has been fractured and unable to heal. It hasn't healed. Time has passed, but it's strange them getting back together, and it's not what it was. Whereas Stannis and Davos, they're not friends. Their relationship is Lord and leal subject, but built on trust. They trust each other. I would even say even in the TV show, they trust each other completely. And not that they're going to tell each other secrets, but Stannis trusts Davos's judgment. Mm-hmm. And he trusts that Davos will always tell him the truth, where his other lords will lie to him just to gain favor.
Right.
And Davos trusts in Stannis, specifically his sense of justice. And that goes back to he saved Stannis's life as well as the whole garrison that was at Storm's End.
Give me your hands.
But Stannis said, it's great that you did that, and I'm going to make you a knight for doing that. But you're a smuggler, and you need to pay for those crimes. And Davos is like, all right, well, you know what? I would never have guessed that me saving your life would cost me my hands, but the way you say it, it makes sense, so fine. But you got to be the one to swing the blade that cuts off my fingers. And Stannis is like, yeah, you know what?
Did he do it once like this?
Yeah, he did it once.
In the thumb too?
No, not the thumb. Those four at the first knuckle.
See?
And he used not a fucking hatchet, it's not an axe, but you took like cut chicken.
Yeah.
He used one of those.
Oh, God. Yeah, it's exactly. On the tip of my tongue. On the tip of my tongue.
Let's see if I can Google. What did Davos get his fingers cut off with?
Oh, what's it called? Oh, it's on the tip of my tongue.
Cleaver.
There you go. Couldn't think of that. We're not cooks.
But their relationship is built entirely on trust and justice and respect. Renly and Loras, it's different. Loras was Renly's squire, as noble boys often are for older noble lords.
Mm-hmm.
But their relationship is one of lust. And in that society, perversion. And secrecy, and presenting their friendship as a friendship where it's really an intimate relationship, hiding its true nature. But if you look at that, Robert and Ned was a real relationship, but if you look deeper, it's not. Because Robert...
This could be a huge spoiler on this one. I'm sorry, Sean. This could be actually a real huge
this
spoiler.
Just in.
This just in. We're spoiling everything.
These are new photos from...
These are new photos, and of course I can't enlarge the picture, but go ahead. We'll talk about it. We'll do a short mini, so we'll talk about it, because this could be very important scene.
Figure out if you get a better resolution picture of that. But
because this is, it could be a very important parchment paper here, lettering here.
Robin and Ned, their relationship started out as buddies, as friends, and the deeper you look at a guy like Robert, the more you see that Ned could have been anybody. And the reason that Ned was so close to him is because Ned is pretty easygoing.
Mm-hmm.
And he has respect for an elder lord. And he knows his place as the second son. And Robert is the kind of guy that just doesn't want to be argued with. He wants yes men. And that's what Ned was to him. Stannis and Davos, that's the realest of the three relationships here.
Right.
It definitely is. Because neither one is pretending to be something that they're not. They both make each other better at what they are. And they never cross the line of, I'm the lord, you're my leal subject. It's never like, come on, Davos, let's go have a couple of drinks. I mean, that's not Stannis in general, but Davos would never expect something like that from Stannis. He wants Stannis to remain as his king, as his lord, and he wants them to be successful. Renly and Loras is just complete bullshit, because they're pretending to be something that they're not. He's marrying his sister to be king, which he has no right being. It's a perversion in that society. It's complete secrecy, even though there's whispers about it. They're so arrogant about it that they won't get found out, that even if they do, it doesn't matter. It's a nice microcosm for Renly in general, because he's so friggin' arrogant that he thinks he could just be king, because his brother was a king. There's a reason that Stannis lasts as long as he does, and it's because of Davos.
Right.
And that's the only reason.
Because Davos kind of like holds him back on some of Stannis's kind of like Bran Starkness in this, that he doesn't let him jump into the fray so quickly. Right.
He's really good at playing devil's advocate for Stannis.
Right, right.
Especially when Stannis is dead set on something, where most people would be like, I'm not going to tell him no. Are you kidding me? You're crazy if you can tell Stannis no. Davos is like, I would never agree with him because he's wrong. And he's my king. I have to be honest with him. I'm not going to lie to him. I can't do that. That's crazy. And while Stannis initially, when he hears that truth from Davos, he's like angry at Davos. As soon as he calms down, that's where the respect is. And that's where the appreciation is. None of his other lords, his wife, Melisandre, none of them will be honest with him the way that Davos is. Mm-hmm. And Davos is generally right because he's got a much different point of view. He's not of the point of view where he's making a power play. He's not trying to raise his own station by telling the king what he wants to hear. He's a commoner. He's a common person, and he has that point of view, which Stannis can't always see because he's a lord. We'll get into those three relationships more when we cover season two, but the Robert and Ned relationship, the protagonist with the status quo, while the antagonist has a newer relationship with the status quo, it's an interesting formula, and one that I didn't see until we started talking about this, and I'm anxious to see how this formula plays out in season two. Let me ask you, in season one of Game of Thrones, who do you think was the best actor, the best performance?
Tough one. I love Sean Bean in it.
I'd have to agree with Sean Bean.
Actor or actress? We're doing both.
We'll do both.
Best actor, I'm going to have to go with Sean Bean. His facial expressions on a lot of the stuff.
Well, just whether or not he knew how things play out, he acted like he definitely knew. You argue that he does know. I could agree with that. But even in him knowing, he can't know that much. Mm-hmm. He can only know the bits and pieces. Now, best actress, I might give it to Emilia Clarke, and this might be the only season that I give it to her for, because she does have a character arc. She does show some vulnerability, and then she does show strength at the end. I could also make a case for Lena Headey, but I know
it's
that...
It's almost like, because you're going to play Lena Headey probably a couple years, season 6. Right.
I know that Lena Headey is going to get plenty of these awards from me, so,
right. So
that's why I'm tempted to go with... That's why I think I'm going to go with Emilia Clarke.
Right. I was thinking the same thing. Like, I would love to say Lena Headey, but I think down the line we're going to put Lena Headey anyway.
She's going to get plenty of... How about this? How about one supporting actor or actress? Not part of the main cast, so not one of the six people we're talking about.
Acting-wise?
Yeah, acting-wise.
Oh, that's a tough one. That really is tough.
You know what? For me, I don't think it's that tough.
I'm either going to say Viserys or Jorah.
Okay. You know what? Now you just made it tougher by saying Jorah. Viserys or Jorah, huh? Viserys is a good one. I'm going to go with Maisie Williams just because that character of Arya Stark, to be played by a young actress, and the gravitas of what that character has to go through while keeping her spunk and spirit. Plus, I know I'm not going to give it to her in later seasons. Your favorite episode, off the top of your head?
Season one?
Baylor, right? That's the one you give the highest to.
I kind of dope if I don't say Baylor, they give it the highest score.
Whereas me, I have three episodes with equally high score. Winter's Coming, Cripples, Bastards, Broken Things, and You Win or You Die. And honestly, I'm going to say my favorite episode is Winter is Coming. Here's a tough one to come up with right off the top of your head. But how about your favorite scene from season one? Most memorable?
Most enjoyable?
However you want to phrase it, what do you think is the best scene from season one?
It's a tough call. Very tough call. There's so many.
What if I go through a few scenes, maybe Ned and Robert in the crypts.
Awesome scene. That's up
there. Sansa, Joffrey, Arya at the Ruby Ford. Tyrion gets captured at the inn at the crossroads. Small council meeting with Ned and Robert and their little showdown. Trial by combat at the Vale. Ned and Cersei in the Godswood. Cyril Farrell fighting off the knights with the wooden sword. The Septs of Baelor and the beheading. The dragon eggs hatch and dragons are born.
You know what? There's so many. When Ned gets betrayed by the Janice Slint. I like that.
The throne room scene.
The throne room scene.
And that's episode 7, right?
Yep. But there's so many, though.
Yeah, I know, there definitely are.
Too much I'm going to say. I like that scene. I like that scene a lot.
You know what? I think I'm going to agree with you. And there's a reason I'm doing this. When we finish off with season 6, I want to come back and have our best from each season and which one we think is the best overall. It's not possible to really pick one, but in a sense, it's doing it. But we'll call this the best adapted scene. How about best original scene for a scene that did not appear in the books?
Oh, I got to think
of this. You have the Robert and Cersei conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
You have the Robert and Renly making the eights.
Mm-hmm. You know what I'm going to say right now? John and Jamie meeting. That's adapted. That's not in the books.
Okay.
That's my favorite scene.
And you like that even better than Jamie and Ned's sword fight?
Yes, because think that's telling me that something down the line is going to happen between John and Jamie.
And it changes what happens in the book because it's just John making note of Jaime.
That's how a true knight should look like. Mm-hmm. Or they even say king. I think they should say king.
A king, yeah. I like that. John and Jaime meeting. And that's episode one, right? Or is that episode two?
Episode one or two. Am I two?
Yeah, it's two.
Because he's going to the Night's Watch.
I'm going to go with Robert and Cersei conversation, which we think is episode 5. But I'm going to go with that just because it's a nice look into the reasons, if any, that their marriage ever worked at all. When we go into season two, we know that the following characters will have larger roles. Maybe Bronn, not so much. He'll have a similar... He had a not a large role in season one, but he had a similar size season two. Maybe a little bit bigger.
Yeah.
Say season two where he caps out. But Theon, we know, will have a larger role. Jaime will have a larger role. Although I don't think it's till season three that he really becomes a main. Right. Tywin, we know, has a larger role in season two. Mm-hmm. Jorah, I don't know. I mean, he had a fairly large role in season one. Can you think of any other characters, somewhat minor roles this season and next season, they become a larger part of things?
Samwell.
I agree with Samwell. Okay.
Roz.
Ugh, somehow. Renly, no. If anything, it's the same and, and he's gone so early. Stannis wasn't in season one, so we can't say him. Loras was in season one. Loras has a larger role, but that's not really till like season four, season five that he's really upgraded.
Upgraded. We upgraded him this season.
I guess that's about it. So season one, Game of Thrones. Very well written. Very well directed. Very well acted. Very well produced. Good job by Benioff and Weiss. Good job by Brian Cogman. Good job by Raman Djawadi. Djawadi? Or Djawadi?
Yeah, well, I don't know.
Whatever the fuck it is.
Djawadi. Djawadi.
He's got enough money from this fucking tour he's doing. Oh, speaking of which, I saw that video you put up of Serj Tanakin from System of a Down. That was fucking sick.
Yeah,
it was,
he has a good voice for that kind of, type of song.
I don't know if I put that up on the Facebook page. I'll check it out later. I'll try to get on there tonight and update some stuff.
That was sick. And then they actually, another one, they had the guy from The National who did the song for season two.
It was for season three they had, or no, it was for season four, band called Sigur Rós. They do the Reigns of Castamere also. And when I first heard it, I'm like, wow, that's even better than The National. But I've listened to it a couple times since then, and it's definitely, it's not. So that's that. Season one. Do you have anything else to add before we stick a fork in season one and move on to season two?
I think that's it. I think it's still either, if it's at the best, still it's at the best season, it's the second best season.
Yeah, agreed.
I think that's pretty much consistent with what a lot of people say. A lot of people always have one out there. Season like five gets trashed on a lot, but
yeah.
I think season three is my least favorite still.
Yeah. You just rewatched it, so you would know.
Although I think I liked it a little bit better than I thought I did on the rewatch. Like there was definitely some episodes I thought, okay, definitely had some good episodes.
See, I'm finding it's dragging a little bit, but I'm also remembering looking forward to the Red Wedding and that kind of propelling me forward with each episode. But I do remember maybe episode 5, 6, 7, or 6, 7, 8 being a little too slow, and knowing that the Red Wedding was coming and just thinking, how are we going to get there? I'm not seeing any Robb Stark. I'm not seeing any Walder Frey. Like, it doesn't... We'll talk about it more when we get to season three, but I remember it much more fondly than I'm actually experiencing it as a rewatch because I was waiting for the Red Wedding. I was so excited for the Red Wedding episode. So I used to think season two might have been the worst until season five, but it's not that bad. I bet you when I get to season five, I bet you I enjoy that more the second time around. That's the whole point of doing this rewatch. You sit with these stories for so long, they have a certain spot in your mind, and when you get back to it...
That's my list right now. That's my...
So this will be interesting, especially because we just went over season one. So yours, 6, 1, 4, 5.
I like 5.
2, 3. Wow.
I like 5.
Now, was it like that when 5 ended originally?
Yeah, I like 5. I like to be a hipster once in a while myself.
Go against,
I know a lot of people don't like when they did the status, but I tell you what, it's happening in the books also.
I mean, I can see Shireen dying. I definitely think
I'm telling you it's happening.
I don't know. How does he get back to the wall to get her?
He does.
I'm going to agree with you with season 6 and then season 1, but then I'm going to agree with you with season 4 also. But then I'm going to diverge and I'm going to go 2, 3, 5. But I'm not as far along in my rewatch as you are. Guys, thanks for listening. We appreciate it. We hope you enjoyed our coverage of season one. We'll be back next week starting our coverage of season two. And we'll have information very soon for our commentary episode. I spoke with P. Blizz, Uncle Pip. I spoke with him over Easter weekend. I saw him at my parents' house in Pennsylvania. We were trying to figure out the logistics because we can't really record the sound for the episode. It's not legal. So we just want to record our commentary watching the show. If you had to pick an episode for season one, what do you think?
Just one?
Just one, for now. But I want to try and at least get one episode for each season.
I think what we should do, I think we should watch the first episode.
I agree. And I think I know which episode in season two we should watch also.
What do you think?
I was thinking Blackwater.
Yeah. Episode three would be Red Wedding.
Yeah.
Now season four, I think that's where it kind of starts getting...
Yeah, because I don't know that we need to watch the Battle at the Wall episode. There might be a better definitive episode of that.
Purple
yeah,
one?
Yeah, maybe.
Season 5, it gets really tough.
Season 5,
It gets really tough.
I don't know. I might have
Season 6 gets tough, too. Battle of the Bastards or the finale.
I think I might go with the finale.
Yeah, I gotta go with the finale also.
We're definitely in agreement with Blackwater.
Red Wedding.
And Red Wedding.
I think the Battle of the Wall, I think we could do Pearl Wedding.
But that should be a lot of fun, and we'll put those up, and then you guys at home can listen to us and watch along with us, and it'll be like you're hanging out with us. If you ever wanted to be one of the watchers on the couch, now's your chance. Thanks for listening. We appreciate it. We'll speak with you guys next week when we start our Season 2 Game of Thrones review, and that's about it. Bum, 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 bum.